animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm back. And I want to thank Bev Capshaw for the stellar job she did hosting the show the last two Wednesdays, one of those being Christmas morning, no less. So we really appreciate her help while we're taking a little time off. As for today's show, my guest is Tom Mustill, a film director who makes nature and wildlife movies. His latest film, The Whale Detective, which airs tonight on PBS, part of the Nature series, is unusually autobiographical. The catalyst for this movie was Mustill and a friend were kayaking in Monterey Bay when a humpback whale breached and just missed landing on them. Not surprisingly, Mustill kept thinking about the experience and kept wondering if the whale was trying to hurt them or trying not to. He began investigating, speaking with an array of whale experts, trying to better understand the whale he began referring to as prime suspect, and it became more and more like a detective procedural. In this conversation recorded Monday, Mustill and I discussed the whale encounter and the film that sprang from it, other movies he's made, mostly about animals, but also one about Greta Thunberg, and more. I'll play back that interview in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later, when we step into the Comedy Corner, we'll do so with a whale-related piece, fittingly enough, and the prize for Name That Animal Tune will be a set of spectacular animal-oriented greeting cards designed by artist extraordinaire Jared Edson. Right now, let's get to my conversation with Tom Mustill. Recorded Monday, this is Tom Mustill on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Thanks very much for having me, Duncan.
So we'll, of course, delve into the whale detective and the incident that triggered it in a moment. But first, I'd like to learn a little bit about you and your background. When did your fascination with wildlife begin?
I think I've always had it, really. I grew up in the city in London. But sort of any opportunity I had, I was always sort of digging around in the garden or in parks. Or if ever we were on holiday, I'd always be off, yeah, looking for other living things to look at. That continued into, I studied zoology at university and worked as a conservation biologist for a while before moving into making films about animals.
Okay, so early on it was kind of more of a scientific bent to it, really, in some ways that propelled you, not so much directly dealing with animals, although you were studying them during that time as well.
I think so. All of those things are also just an opportunity to be around them. Yeah.
So tell me about your transition then from scientist and studying what you did in university to becoming a filmmaker. What were those first steps like?
Well, it was a sort of an accident, really. I worked as a conservation biologist because I wanted to try and, you know, do my bit to try and halt the loss in species that we're having and biodiversity decline. I just wanted to try and help with that. But I found working in nature reserves in the middle of nowhere, I got really lonely. I got dumped by my girlfriend because I disappeared for half a year.
Oh,
into
wow.
A tropical rainforest.
Yikes.
I wasn't even that sure that I was that good at it. But I always liked telling stories, and always at university when I would have an interesting lecture, I'd always go and tell my friends who were doing other courses about the stuff that I was learning. And so I thought, well, maybe I could, by telling stories about conservation and people who are really impressive, I might be able to have more of an impact in conservation than actually being a conservation biologist.
Right. Well, that makes sense. Yes. As you thought, hey, I can tell stories and continue my interest in conservation and animals and zoology and biology. Was there an initial film project that sort of bridged those two things where you thought, wow, this is exactly the right thing for me? This is my aha moment, in a sense.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It took a while to get there. I mean, at first I just started working as what's called a runner, which is, I guess the American word is like a gopher, you know, just like making tea and doing errands for people at a TV company in London.
Sure.
And they made all sorts of films, from things about how the ancient Egyptian pyramids were built, to stories of mountaineers, and occasionally they do animal things. And I found myself doing all sorts of weird errands, like buying fake blood for reconstruction animal attacks, and and dressing up as a monk in a reconstruction of the building of Chartres Cathedral. And that was great. But my first job that like that you described was on a series called Inside Nature's Giants, which I think was called Animal Autopsy in the States. And that went out on PBS, and it was a huge hit. And what we did was we waited until an animal would die, a really big one, sadly, like a whale or a lion or a hippopotamus or a giraffe, and then we dissect it with experts and scientists to show how it worked, and that was a huge success, and it won lots of awards, and it ran for many seasons, and that really gave me the opportunity of both sort of doing some quite pioneering filmmaking and learning the trade from people who are really good at it, and some lots of adventures as well.
Yeah, so I would think though that as much as that sounds like a great set of experiences, and working with accomplished filmmakers was probably pivotal, I'm going to guess from what little I guess I know about you, but just subsequently, that the idea of working with animals that were very much alive probably was extremely appealing in the wake of the animal autopsy experience.
Yeah, I definitely. Well, a nice thing that we did in the show is we tried to show the anatomy in the dead animal, and then we'd go and film with live animals in the wild.
Yeah.
So we'd show how a lion's claws can protract, looking at the tendons and the muscles.
So it sounds like, although the name of the show is Animal Autopsy, and that's what was happening, there was a broader array of things to each episode that showed the living version of the animal. So was the idea, though, to kind of show what illness or what befell that particular animal as a way to sort of tell their overall story just as a species?
I think there was definitely an element of that. So for each animal, we explained what had happened to it, you know, what had caused its death. But it was more of a way of looking at what was special about that animal and that species. You know, how does it, for instance, the giant squid, an animal that lives, you know, thousands of meters under the sea, how does it cope with that intense pressure? How does it grow that big? How does it find a mate to reproduce? How does its eye work? And really, it was quite an old-fashioned program. You know, looking at anatomy is a very old bit of biology. And we did some of the first new dissection. We did the first, I think, full giraffe dissection that had been done, I think, in a century, of this particular part of its anatomy called the left recurrent laryngeal nerve, which is this enormous nerve.
Wow.
That goes from the brain to the larynx. But because of the evolutionary process, in the fishy ancestor of us and all mammals, that nerve went from the fish's brain to sort of somewhere near its gills. But then as the heart moved down, it pulled into the chest and further down as over evolution, you know, the fish grew limbs and grew a longer body, then the nerve had to loop down from the brain under the heart and back up to where the larynx is. And then in a giraffe, because its neck is so long, the nerve runs all the way from the brain, all the way down its neck, underneath the heart, and all the way back up, just to do a journey that's only really a few inches from where the nerve needs to start and needs to finish. So I think that had last been done by the guy who instructed Charles Darwin.
So, oh my God, wow, that is historical. Yeah for sure.
Because
it's also interesting that you talk about how some of these things hadn't been done in some time, and heading the other direction, it seems like these days, at least in schools, there's been a huge movement for a number of years now to not dissect animals, but to accomplish the same kind of learning that you could do through kind of old school dissection through virtual reality, other kinds of computerized models and things, so that the classic, at least in the U.S., the classic frog dissection in biology and other things like that, but also other things that were happening in vet schools and even in med schools, you know, were no longer required because you could still get that same sort of knowledge and training without involving a corpse or a dead animal. So
absolutely. And I think we felt sort of a bit part of that because we had an audience of millions and millions of people. They were all getting a bit of that education. And we had vets writing in saying how excited it was because, you know, also we were looking at animals that they'd never normally get to see. You know, a giant squid.
Yeah.
They don't turn up very often. It's only every year or two
that they
tend to get caught in one place in the world.
Yeah.
Or a sperm whale. You know, to dissect a sperm whale takes 3 digger trucks and like 30 people and days and days and days. And you have to be able to be in a place where a whale sadly dies and is in a good enough condition that it hasn't decomposed. So most of what we know about whales, for instance, just comes from whaling and from scientists who were sort of aboard whaling ships and were able to look at the specimens there. And we also released an app and a book trying to maximize the good that we could make out of those sad animal deaths.
So these animals that were selected and highlighted in these things, they came to your awareness, the filmmakers, because they were ill or of a certain age or whatever. So it was clear that they were soon to die when they were, I guess, selected to be featured in the program. But that part of it and the autopsy that ensued was also sort of a jumping off ground for a much broader set of information and education that the program highlighted.
Yes, exactly. And we didn't really... the animals in the first series, there are a few animals. We basically got in touch with all the zoos in Europe and said, you know, because there's so many animals, obviously some are old and some die and there are some accidents.
Yeah.
We said, if that happened, could we come and do an anatomical dissection? You know, this is all with vets and scientists. But then in the second series, we worked with wild animals, which was even more complicated because we had to go to places where it was likely that wild animals would die. And so for the sperm whale, for instance, we had I set up like a sort of network of every single marine stranding authority in basically the northern in a place we could reach within a short flight. So all of northern Europe and the east coast of the US and Scandinavia, and just said, you know, if a whale strands, could you call us and we'll be on the next plane out there to help with the post-mortem.
Wow. And
then we just had to wait, you know, and see what turned up. So, you know, you just have to respond. You know, one moment you'd just be in bed and the phone would ring and someone would say, there's a sperm whale on the beach.
Right.
And you'd be throwing your stuff in a bag and trying to get down on the next train for that. That was in the UK.
Wow. So it really requires kind of a nimble response to really get there when it in a timely fashion. Because if you took too long to get there, I suppose the body would start to decompose and things that you wanted to show or do, that opportunity would leave you behind.
Exactly. You know, you'd lose all that opportunity for that information.
Yeah.
And to be able to show it to people. Because, you know, the longer an animal's been dead, the more the less you can see the fine structures and get an understanding of how they work.
Yeah. And then I think you've done films involving other animals that were very much alive, as some of the youth in animal autopsy were. So I guess I'm curious, setting aside the whale detector for now, was there a film that felt particularly powerful to you personally, or an animal with whom you felt a notable kinship, either that specific animal or maybe that animal as a species?
Well, so I guess all this time I've been thinking of how could I get back to conservation biology? My fascination is where people and animals meet. The first big opportunity to do a film on that was for the BBC. And it was a documentary called The Batman of Mexico. And there was this extraordinary man I'd heard about called Rodrigo Medellin, who was a professor in Mexico City, and he studied an animal that most people hate, which is bats. But bats are extremely important. They pollinate crops, they spread seeds, they eat pests. But most people just think they're sort of gross and that they spread diseases, and they think of vampire bats. So I made a documentary with Rodrigo following the migration of a particularly beautiful little bat called the lesser long-nosed bat. And that flies all the way from caves south of Mexico City, all the way up the Pacific coast of Mexico into the Sonoran Desert, into the southern U.S. And along its journey, it pollinates the agaves. And those plants, they're what tequila and mezcal are made out of. So
sure.
Without these bats, there wouldn't be tequila and mezcal. And he had been so effective at stopping the destruction of the roosting caves of these bats and protecting them, that they were going to be the first mammal in all of North America. so that's Mexico, Canada, and the United States, to be taken off the endangered species list. So an amazing conservation success story.
Wow.
Yeah, and he was a brilliant guy, and it was an opportunity to film bats in ways that people hadn't before and kind of show how cute and interesting and important they are. And David Attenborough narrated the film, and it was a big success, and he's now launched bat-friendly tequila. So if you drink tequila, you can have ones that are better for the bats and mezcal, and he's just recently been made National Geographic's first explorer in residence who's Hispanic, and that was also a really good moment, because there's a lot of representation of, you know, like, I guess, white posh guys like me on the UN wildlife program,
right?
And I think that's sad. I think that's something I'd like to work as part of to change.
Yeah, well, it sounds like Rodrigo is blazing a trail for that in all kinds of ways.
He's wonderful. Yeah, and that was kind of the perfect combination for me, because you got to film somebody who was doing something exciting, you know, like all the heroes that I'd learned about when I was working in conservation and doing my course.
Yeah.
And I got to have a huge adventure all across Mexico and spend a lot of time around lots of different bats.
Well, let me let folks know, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is filmmaker Tom Mustill, whose autobiographical documentary is The Whale Detective, which premieres on Wednesday evening, January 8th, on PBS as part of the Nature series. The film was spurred by the experience Mustill and a friend had while kayaking in Monterey Bay. A humpback whale breached and nearly landed on top of them. And we'll hear all about that in a moment. This conversation was recorded Monday. As much as I'd like to hear about some of the other projects, especially something as fascinating as the Batman of Mexico turned out to be, I feel like it's incumbent on us to get to The Whale Detective. So so let's get to that. First, if you would transport us back to that fateful day and kind of set the scene. How is it that you and your friend Charlotte were out kayaking that day? Were you on vacation, or what spurred that to begin with?
Yeah, that's correct. I was on vacation with a big bunch of friends, and it was the almost the last day of our holiday. We'd been spending a lot of time in California, going all over the place. I was friends with some engineers and biologists at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, which sits in a harbor called Moss Landing, and is one of the world's best sort of cutting-edge underwater technology places. And they'd been making some underwater robots and autonomous vehicles, which I'm a bit of a geek, and I was really into that. So I went to visit them, and I looked out the window, and there were all these humpback whales just on the water, just, you know, within about half a mile of the Institute. And my friends said, well, you've got to go and see them while you're here, and the best way to do that's on a kayak. So I got the last few places on a kayak trip, and signed myself up, and I asked my friends who'd like to go, and Charlotte said that she'd like to go. So the next morning at 5 o'clock, we set out on the water on a tour, and we paddled out, and it was a really calm, quiet morning. It was quite cold and misty. We passed sort of California sea lions barking, rafts of sea otters, which hang out in Moss Landing, and then got out onto the water. And I'd worked on a whale-watching boat, making sure that it didn't get too close, because it's really important with marine mammals to give them their space and not harass them. So we stayed a good distance from the whales and saw all sorts of amazing lunge feeding, and there were loads of whales there,
yeah.
Humpback whales. And occasionally they'd come up and they'd exhale, and you'd smell their breath, which is like a kind of fishy broccoli.
yeah, probably heavier on the fish than the broccoli, I'm guessing, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Unless there's some underwater broccoli place we haven't heard of
yet.
Right,
exactly,
Charlotte, I've seen loads of whales because I've always been very interested in them, but Charlotte is an accountant, and she'd never seen a whale or a dolphin before, so I think it was all a bit much for her. And after a couple of hours, the guide said, okay, great, let's go back to shore now. And I think we were all, you know, we felt like we'd had a great time. And so we started paddling back in towards the harbor. And we were really close to the shore. And then suddenly, a adult humpback whale just shot out of the water very nearby. And it arced up into the air above us, and it became very clear it was going to land on top of us.
That's, I mean, among the many things I'm interested in, Tom, at that point, did it shift into that sort of car accident slow motion mode when the whale was up in the air and you saw how close it was? I mean, did you just think, holy crap, this whale might well land right on top of us?
You put your finger on it exactly, Duncan. I've been in one serious car accident where fortunately everybody was okay, but that was the closest thing to it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like things slowed down. It was that it just became very clear that we were going to collide with the whale. And in the car accident I was in, I just remember just thinking, oh, we're going to hit that car. And then we did. And so with the whale, it came out of the sea, and just by looking at its trajectory, you know, it just happened so quickly. You know, one moment, this flat, calm ocean, and then just, and then it landed on top of us and dragged us underwater. And I wasn't scared, and I don't think Charlotte was then, because not because we were brave, just because there was no time to have any really emotional response. I just remember my brain thinking, ah, there's a whale, or ah, it's going to land on us. That means we're dead.
So when you say it landed on us, I mean, from what I know, and since I'm still speaking to you, it means you're alive and well. It was kind of a glancing blow, right? It didn't really land directly on you guys, or I think we would have had a very different story. But maybe I misunderstood, but I thought it came super, super close and looked to many, including you guys, but others who were observing from a distance, like it was headed directly for you and the kayak, but just missed. Do I have that wrong?
It hit the kayak,
but not you guys.
Oh, that's correct. Yeah, yeah, if it had touched us, it'd have been game over.
And right.
I mean, we were in a two-person kayak, and if you think about it, when you're squeezed into a two-person kayak, there's not very much of the kayak that hasn't got human in it.
Yeah,
you know,
there's
just the ends.
Right.
And so the whale was coming up, and it was going to land fully on us, and that was the last thing I saw, because I flipped the kayak over at that point and threw my paddle away. What it did after that point was it changed its trajectory, so it landed with the bulk of its body parallel and right next to the kayak, and its pectoral fin, which is about a 3 meter long, the biggest arm in the animal, well, in, you know, on Earth, its flipper, which is huge and bony, that smacked onto the nose of the kayak and crumpled it in. And what we think happened is that because the kayak was flipped over and we were now facing upside down, you know, our heads in the water, that force of it whacking us shot us out of the kayak on the other side.
Mm.
And that's how we were able to get out of the kayak. And then as the whale's body sort of continued underwater, we were sucked down with the boat, with the whale, and sucked and deeper underwater.
In this day and age, I suppose it's unsurprising that someone captured this all on video, I guess from a nearby kayak or the shore of Mount Clair, and that, of course, that video went viral. I mean, it's also kind of, well, it is surprising, I guess, but it may be more disturbing, anyway, that the person shooting the video seems to be thrilled to have captured this encounter with zero concern for how the humans on the kayak might have fared, right? I mean, I couldn't believe it. But to what extent was that not that person's attitude, but that viral video clip, as well as the experience itself, to what extent was that the impetus for the film that you've made?
Well, I'll just quickly address the screams, because I think because we were going back to shore, and so we were going away from where the whales were.
Yeah.
The video was taken by someone on a whale-watching boat that was nearby.
Right.
And I think almost everybody else was pointed in the other direction.
Yeah, I see.
And so what you see when a whale breaches is often it comes out the water and then everyone turns over to look at it. And I think because we were on the far side of the whale and most people hadn't even seen it come out, they just saw a big splash. And they thought, we filmed a whale breaching.
Okay.
And there was a woman in the background, you can hear shouting, like, the kayak, the kayak. And I think she's like the only person who'd realized that there were some people there.
Okay.
So I think that
helps me have some restored faith in humanity, because otherwise it sounded
exactly.
The guy who was filming it that was so thrilled with what he had captured. But I thought it was apparent to him that it was a kayak and there was obviously people on that kayak, and he couldn't have made less of a mention of that. He's just thrilled with capturing this incredible footage. So I thought, wow, that's a little on the heartless side for me. But
he does come across a bit brutal. But I think he just didn't realize, and because we were on the far side of the whale to him,
okay.
I think again it wasn't clear whether it had hit us or just swamped our boat and tipped us out.
But this
happened in 2015.
Right.
So it's a good few years ago now, and not everybody had, you know, video abilities on their cell phones, and not everybody was uploading things to YouTube.
Right.
And I was desperate for someone to have photographed it or filmed it, because I knew that no one would believe me. I went back to our accommodation where Charlotte and I were staying with the rest of our friends, and we rushed in and said, a whale just landed on our kayak. And they all thought, okay, sure, you know, maybe something happened, but that's surely an exaggeration. And our friend Louise said, okay, well, whatever, but you're late. We've had to clean your rooms up for you, and if we don't get out of here soon, we'll be fined an extra $25 for late checkout.
So first things first. Yeah, exactly.
So I was after that, I thought, oh no, no one's gonna think this is true. And it was only a couple of days later, I went camping in Big Sur and came back, that I saw the video pop up on the internet. And I just thought, oh, thank goodness, then now people will believe me about this.
Oh, go ahead, Tom, sorry.
Oh, yeah, sorry. And so the film, I just sort of went back to work making wildlife documentaries at the BBC. And I thought I should make, I became fascinated with whales, but I didn't really know what to do, because it felt like the most exciting thing that could happen had already happened. So what more was there to say?
Right.
But I got more and more hooked into the community of people in Monterey Bay, and especially into what was happening with the whales in the United States. I thought, oh, well, maybe I can use what happened to me and maybe combine it with some other viral clips of whales and people colliding to tell a sort of bigger story about whales and people in the United States.
Yeah, it occurs to me now as you're saying that almost in an echo of the autopsy film that we talked about a bit earlier, where there was a specific thing that happened and that animal was being dissected, but it was jumping off point for a much broader look at that particular animal or that particular species. And really, it sounds like in some ways that description really kind of covers the whale detective, because that is obviously the catalyst for what happened to you on the kayaks. But you do speak to all kinds of whale experts really trying to like puzzle this out, like what happened and why did it happen. You were back making films and you had this incredible footage. So when did it seem to clear, like, hey, I could, not only was this a pretty wild story that I can dine out on for decades, that what happened to me out in Monterey Bay, but there's a film here. There's actually a film here of some substance.
I think it was in finding out that the whales were in real trouble. I think that felt like there was an urgency to telling this story.
Okay.
So that was one side, was you know, and I think your point you made about animal autopsy and the jumping off point is spot on. I've never thought about that. And the other thing was when I realized that I might actually be able to find something out about this whale. It seems ridiculous, you know, like a huge animal collides with you somewhere in the wild,
in
the ocean, and then just goes back and disappears again. To think you'd be able to find out anything. But because a few people had taken photographs of it as it landed on us, I thought, well, maybe that's a start. But that idea got binned pretty quickly, because none of those photos had the whale's tail in them. And that's the critical thing. If you're a whale scientist, you identify individual whales by looking at the flukes, the big flat bits at the end of their tail. And we couldn't see that. But then I got put in touch with this guy called Ted, who runs an organization called Happy Whale, which is a website where you can upload all of your photographs from whale watching, from humpback whales. And now he uses computer algorithms, but back then he used people to try and match them to the catalogs of identified whales. And he thought that if he went into his archives, he'd be able to get all the other photographs taken that day and at least try and identify some of the whales, you know, and figure out, okay, well, who was around? You know, maybe it's one of them. But I never dreamt we'd discover what we did.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, because you do speak to a number of experts. And again, I just want to quickly say we're speaking with the filmmaker Tom Mustill, whose documentary, The Whale Detector, premieres on Wednesday night, January 8th on PBS. And the film involves an investigation by Mustill after a humpback whale breached and nearly landed on top of Mustill and a friend while they were kayaking in Monterey Bay. This conversation was recorded Monday. So, yeah, so that path that you're on, and I don't want to, I mean, you do speak to a number of experts, and I don't want to address them all because I don't want to have spoilers here. We got people that we don't want people to tune into the movie. But I mean, I have to say, there are some experts I guess I feel particularly compelled to touch on. I mean, Ted, of course, was one just by having that whole bank of photos of tails and how you can identify the whales that way. But I also was super intrigued by this highly specialized realm of experts who disentangle whales from lines and nets. And it just seems like the skill and the danger of that kind of work just seem monumental. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Oh, yes. And this was one of the things that I was most keen to try and include in the film, because I couldn't really think of anything braver or more complicated than trying to, like, disentangle an injured whale at sea in a tiny boat. And that's what people do. You know, they do it all over the U.S., on the East Coast, in the West Coast, up in Alaska, and out in the Hawaiian Islands. And it's very dangerous. People have been killed doing it. I mean, if you think about it, a humpback whale, I think, is 2 to 3 times the size of a Tyrannosaurus rex. Wow. And they get caught up in fishing gear, most of the time, often like crab pots with a line coming up, so they're anchored to the bottom, or a ghost net, which is when the fishermen cut an old net loose and just throw it in the sea and they can drift around. And if a whale gets trapped in one of these, it hasn't got any fingers, it can't pull itself free.
Yeah.
And it can get horrendously caught, and the net can cut deep into it, and they die in vast numbers. So there's these teams who train themselves up to go out, and using knives and poles and drones and GoPros to look under the water, they will gradually try and cut the whale free. And they've had great successes with that. And so I really wanted to include that in the film. And that took a long time to get permission from the authorities and get trained up so that we wouldn't get in the way or make it more dangerous. And then we just had to wait and see if a whale was entangled, and we'd get the opportunity to go and film the rescue effort.
Yeah.
Because sadly, most of the time what happens is someone sees an entangled whale and then it's gone. You know, by the time they've got the team together to go back and find it, it's just disappeared back into the ocean. So often they'll put like a buoy with a GPS, and they'll try and attach that to the entangled whale if they have to leave it overnight so they can find it the next day.
Sure.
And I think it's very heartbreaking for these people because they're getting these alerts all the time. You know, a fisherman's seen an entangled whale, or, you know, a whale-watching boat has seen one, and then they go out and they try to find it, and it's gone, and they know that that's probably, you know, not going to have a good outcome for that whale.
Well, and also I thought it was really important to include, because a lot of times on social media you'll see like a nice clip of some kind of sea critter that's entangled in something, and obviously the point of the clip is you'll see them freed from whatever it was. So in those kind of things, it's all friendly and upbeat and sweet and whatever, but you don't get a sense from that you get from your film about what the supreme danger there really is, at least when it comes to whales and trying to disentangle them. So even people who have nothing but the whale or whatever animal's best intentions at heart, I mean, it's really risky, and obviously with the whale, the risk is literally gargantuan.
Yeah, exactly. It's astonishing, really. I mean, if you think about it, like I would hesitate if I saw a dog trapped in like a fence, you know, of just approaching it. But this is an animal that's absolutely enormous, and it's on the sea, you know, where you'll be fighting winds and waves, and if you get knocked unconscious, you know, you could drown, and it's extremely complicated, and these they're all volunteers who do it. They're very impressive people, and you're based in Florida, I think, is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
And there must be people who do marine mammal rescue down there, I guess, with the manatees and things.
I think there are, and again, all kinds of sea creatures that are much smaller than a humpback whale or so again, it's not without its own peril and risks, obviously, even there. But I was really struck by how And they really emphasize that, hey, you have to have been doing this for a number of years. You have to be highly, highly trained. And even then, the risks are tremendous. And it was really interesting, as just as a side note from your investigative journey there. So we're just in the last moment or two of our time here, Tom. But so I guess the central question that propels the film is whether the humpback prime suspect, as you start referring to him as you get more and more into your detective mode, is whether the whale was trying to hurt you or trying not to hurt you. And without giving too much away, because again, we do want people to watch the whole film, do you want to hint at any sort of conclusion that you arrived at on that topic?
Well, I asked pretty much everybody that I met, I asked. And because I'm already a wildlife filmmaker, I know a lot of underwater videographers and a lot of scientists, and they all had their own theories. I think it, despite what we've done to whales, the broader pick, you know, with whaling and hunting them so remorselessly and running them over by accident with our boats and catching them in net, they do not seem to have, in general, animosity towards humans. And indeed, there are even examples like in Cabo San Lucas in Mexico in the Pacific, where gray whales, where they were renowned for their aggression towards whalers, seem to be interested in humans and come towards them and show their calves, people in boats, and will even be touched and rubbed by people. Whales are so, they have such large brains, and they live for such a long time, and they're social, and they seem, to many of them, to be inquisitive about people, and there is really very few evidences of any whale attacks on people, and no unprovoked attacks. And so that was always the framing for what happened. It seemed like it would be extremely weird for a whale to want to breach onto a person. Also, because humpback whales' weapons isn't breaching. They fight using their arms. They're like, they karate chop, and their tails, they're much more powerful.
Yeah.
So if a whale did want to do me in, that probably wouldn't have been the way it would have wanted to do it.
Right.
I don't want to spoil it too much, but in the film we go into trying to explain, well, what if it wasn't trying to hurt us? What does that behavior mean? You know, had we just wandered into something else, or is that how they communicate? That's just a fascinating area.
Yeah.
I should probably add, I don't really know how to say this without it being a spoiler. But what's not included, since the film was finished, we've had some amazing news, which is that Ted, using Happy Whale, has discovered that whale is still alive, and prime suspect is alive and well, and has returned to Monterey Bay just this summer.
Oh, great.
Which is such a relief, because Charlotte and I had, you know, the more we learnt about that whale, the more we learnt about the threats that whales face in that environment, more concerned we were for it.
Sure.
So it's there, it's happy, and it's happy. I don't know if it's happy, sorry.
That's
well,
great, yeah. And it expects to see you out on the water on a kayak at your next opportunity to say hello, probably.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. That's great.
Perhaps not quite as
close up
this time.
Okay. So one last quiz question, totally on a different topic, but just some stuff I kind of stumbled across in preparing to speak with you. Is there a film about Greta Thunberg that you are involved with?
Oh, yeah, that's correct. Yes. Yeah, so I'm writing a book at the moment, but I took a couple of months off to, ahead of the... when she came across to the UN for that big climate talks and the marches.
Right. Yeah.
There was a writer in the UK called George Monbiot. I don't know if people have heard of him in the States, but he's an environmental writer, and he's a really impressive guy. And he'd been talking a lot about something called natural climate solutions, which is, I didn't really know much about, but this is using natural systems to fight climate change. So forests can soak up loads of carbon, mangrove swamps can do it, whales sequester carbon from the surface, and when they when they go to the bathroom, that sinks to the bottom of the sea. And when they die, they sink. So all these living systems can pull carbon out of the air and help stop climate change. Nobody knew about this. And George and Greta Thunberg together had written a letter, an open letter to government saying, look, you know, this only gets 2% of the funding of other carbon capture technologies, but this technology is just trees. You know, we can start implementing it now, yet it can stop estimated a third of climate change. So I thought this would be a great film. People need to know about this.
So
we managed to get Greta just before, the day before she started her long journey to the United States.
Oh, wow.
We had her last afternoon. So we took the train to Sweden. The film was carbon neutral. We only used recycled footage. The only new things we filmed were with her and the interview with George. And we edited together a short film. And then we released it, and we didn't really know what people would think about it, but it went crazily viral, and it's now been seen like 54 million times, and Justin Trudeau tweeted it. It was extraordinary, and I think it really, obviously, it resonated with people. That we should be using the natural world, as an ally.
Well, she really resonates with people, and again, sometimes that work cuts the other way for some people, which that's a whole other conversation, but she obviously has had a profound connection with all kinds of people and really made an impact, and I look forward to tracking down that film.
It's called Nature Now. You can find it all over the place because we released it for free. So if anybody listening would like to play it in a school or anywhere else, they're welcome to do so, and they're welcome to get in touch with me. I'm on social media at Tom Muffdill, and you can just tweet me or Instagram message me, and I can send you a high quality copy.
That's great. All right, Tom. Well, we've been speaking with Tom Muffdill. Again, his documentary, The Whale Detective, premieres Wednesday night, January 8th, on PBS, part of the Nature series. I think by now we've covered kind of what happens to set off that film, but it's about many other things, as we've also touched on. So you'll really enjoy checking it out. And Tom, we'll keep track of your next films and other things, and hopefully speak to you again on Talking Animals. Thanks for making the time to join us today.
Thanks very much for having me. I hope you enjoyed the film.
Okay, thanks. I really did, yeah.
Okay.
Great. Thanks again. Bye-bye. All right, my thanks again to Tom Muffdill for speaking to us on Talking Animals. And again, The Whale Detective premieres tonight, as in January 8th, this very evening, on Nature on your local PBS station. If you can't catch it then, it will re-air, and you can also view it, I believe, online at a certain point, probably after the premiere. Check out the website for Nature on PBS for all those details and other airings and how you might watch it otherwise. We're going to step now into the Comedy Corner for a piece chosen for two reasons. It's about whales and is by Jake Johansson. Indeed, this is a piece called Whale Watching by Jake Johansson in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Last year, I took my family on a vacation. We thought it was a good idea. We were going to go whale watching, and which I thought was a good idea because I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Iowa, where whale watching was not on the menu. You could go cow watching, which does not sound that good. But let me tell you something: you go cow watching, you see some damn cows. Right. That's right off the bat, you know where the cows are, and you go there, and they're there. And then you look at them until you're done. And so that's what I thought whale watching was going to be like. I thought, well, someone knows where the whales are, and we're going to go there, and we're going to watch them, right? That's what they call it. And they're so big, right? How can you miss them? Whales are so big. Well, whales are big, but you know what else is big? The Pacific Ocean. It turns out that thing is really big compared to the amount of whales that are in it. When you look at it that way, like, for example, I think hypothetically they could take all the whales out of the ocean and it wouldn't really go down that much, right? Well, that's what I'm saying. It wouldn't be like you went to the beach and felt like, well, did someone take the whales out of here? It's low. You wouldn't even know. But we were not thinking like that. When we made the plan, we were optimistic. We thought we'll pay our $50 each to go on a 3.5-hour whale watching excursion. That's what they call it, excursion. And I thought this is going to be great. You know, we're going to be sick of looking at whales after 3.5 hours. And they don't tell you that three people are going to throw up the whole time. Seasick, right? And it turned out my daughter was the first person to throw up. Right, she's 8, and we were 20 minutes in to the 3.5-hour trip. I know, I felt terrible as a parent. I didn't see it coming, and of course, her attitude about whale watching, 180. Yeah, as soon as she threw up, she was like, "Daddy, I do not want to go whale watching anymore. I want to go back to the dock, make them turn the boat around." And then I had to explain to her, "Well, I'm sorry, honey, but everyone else pay to go whale watching." So now I'm explaining capitalism to an 8-year-old while she's throwing up. So that is a tough sell. And then by the time we get to the place where the whales are supposed to be, my wife and I are at a point with our seasickness where we are not throwing up, but 100% of our consciousness is devoted to not throwing up. That's all we could. I think we've all been there at some point from drinking, where, you know, you're just hanging onto a pole, kind of, "I'm okay, don't touch me." And then that's when the guide says, "Well, there's a whale off the right-hand side of the boat." So, of course, we're all, "I would love to see that whale." And then you get over there and you see the tail of a whale, a huge whale. It's about 200 yards away, but the tail goes up and then boom, you're right, classic. And I thought, "Well, this is awesome, let's go look at that whale." And then the guide says, "No, they're usually down for 2 hours after that behavior." Right, like he's, "Well, so we saw that whale," and I'm like, "Well, I didn't really get a good look at it." And then he says, we have to go find more whales, and he said we saw two more whales. I'm pretty sure one of those was a bag. But by the end, you don't want to get off the boat. You're like, just high five, that was a whale. Let's go back. And then by the time you get home, you realize what a dumbass you are, right? Because we all have a TV full of whales right in our house. You know, you can DVR whales on demand when you go home, right? Or you can take the guesswork out of it. That's what we did. We rented a National Geographic whale watching DVD, which I recommend. It's 2 hours nonstop. Every minute of the DVD has a whale. Even when there's a guy talking, there's a whale behind him. Like, "Well, I'm still here." Yeah, if you want to feel like you went whale watching, just open a can of tuna while you're watching the DVD and give it a sniff. Because, yeah. Tuna smells just like the ocean. And then if you want to, you know, you can put your fingers in there. "Oh, that was a big wave." Or if you want to be 100% authentic, you just throw 50 bucks out the window and make yourself puke on the rug. Yeah, you just went whale watching.
That was Jake Johansson with a piece called Whale Watching, taken from one of his zillion performances on The David Letterman Show. Coming up at 11 on WMNF is Rob Lori with Radioactivity, extending this 3-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lole. Then at 1 p.m., the music kicks back in with Euro Radio, hosted by Paco Morales, flowing into Scott Elliott and All Souls edition of It's the Music at 2 p.m., continuing into the afternoon, the evening, and beyond. Meanwhile, today's show is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a set of spectacular, and I do mean spectacular, animal-oriented greeting cards designed by artist extraordinaire Jared Edison. In fact, let's get into that now. I am Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. Time to proceed indeed to Name That Animal Tune. There'll be a prize, that set of animal-oriented greeting cards created by Jared Edson. Really cool looking. To the first person that calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's a big animal. It's not a whale, but it's a pretty big animal. Let's just give you that clue if you need one. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. We'll be right back. we'll take any guesses that may come in. Right now, I'm happy to say we think we have a little time to hear a bird song for one of my favorite albums of 2019 overall, not just animal-related. The music here is great from top to bottom, by which I'm referring to Stephanie Seymour's There Are Birds. And it's gotten some nice play at the various places, some nice press coverage, but it's a really, really great album. I suggest you check out Stephanie Seymour, There Are Birds, and we're going to hear something from it right now on Talking Animals called House Sparrow. That's music from Stephanie Seymour. The album is There Are Birds. All sort of bird-related songs, either literally or metaphorically, but great, great music and all kinds of great musicians, people from the E Street Band and others that have contributed to it. So, again, a real treat if you want to check it out. Stephanie Seymour, There Are Birds, and what we heard there was House Sparrow. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I invite you to join me next week when my guest will be Dr. Edinger, a veterinarian and expert on cancer in pets. So hope you'll join me for that conversation. I also invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there as well. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Instagram page, our Twitter feed, and more. So like us on Facebook, the show and or me personally, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You can also subscribe to our newsletter and find out about our guests beforehand. All that's at talkinganimals.net. This is Duncan Strauss on Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Largo, and beyond.